Goodbye.
It now seems unlikely that incumbent Donald Trump can reverse Biden's projected win, and many wonder if Republicans in this gun-filled nation will take to the streets in protest. For months, domestic media stoked fears that a lot of right-wing violence will occur should Trump lose.
A lot, no. Could there be isolated incidents? Sure. But, you know, America is full of over 330 million people. And I would say that 99.999% of them will not do anything violent. They don't want to attack their neighbors, no matter what their neighbors' political thoughts are or how they voted.
However, it's hard to predict what will occur after such virulent accusations of fraud and the long-term demonization of Trump supporters who did prevail at every election level except the presidential. Protests at Electoral College meeting places were held in multiple states, and the Michigan State Capitol was closed because local police said credible threats of violence had been made. A majority of Democrats never accepted Trump's win as legitimate, and now it seems that a majority of Republicans are opposed to the Electoral College's election of Biden. That makes for a worrying pattern, but the main concern right now is, will there be significant election-related violence? Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Angry reactions continue to pour in against the recent normalization of ties between Morocco and Israel. This time, Palestinian Legislative Council in the Gaza Strip held a press conference to condemn the deal that came at the expense of the Palestinian cause.
Normalization is not a normal. It's a misleading term. It is a misleading term. It is a false term. There is no normalization with the occupation in the history. Every country suffered from occupation, tried by all means to defend themselves, even by armed struggle, in order to liberate their land. For this reason, we are refusing normalization of any country, especially a country like Morocco.
Morocco is the fourth state to make such an agreement with the Israeli regime since August, despite the Moroccan people's refusal of the deal that has also been struck recently with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. The Moroccan king claimed he agreed to start the relations with Israel to expand economic and cultural cooperation and advance regional stability and peace.
These deals can never bring peace for Israel. The current crisis will never come to an end until the last Zionist leaves our land. The normalization deals only embolden Israel to commit more crimes.
Palestinians call on the Arab nations to dismiss these normalization deals and protest against their leaders' decisions that Palestinians consider a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
The Israeli regime should be put on trial for its crimes and violations of Palestinian rights in the International Criminal Court. The Arab nations should voice their anger at the normalization deals.
U.S. used Morocco's Western Sahara claim as a bargaining chip in talks with Morocco to secure the deal and agreed to recognize Rabat's sovereignty over the territory.
While the fourth Arab country has started normalizing ties with the Israeli regime, Palestinians here stress that no deal can bring peace to the occupied territories. They say the resistance is the only way to defend the Palestinian rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The recitation of a poem by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan during a military parade in Azerbaijan Republic was strongly condemned by the Iranian lawmakers and the government officials. Right after his statements, which Iran believes may fan separatism among Azeri minority, Tehran summoned the Turkish envoy. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif in a tweet rejected the remarks, saying that no one can talk about Iran's quote, beloved Azerbaijan. Although the Turkish foreign minister has given assurances in a phone call with Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif that Ankara respects the Islamic Republic's sovereignty and territorial integrity, the members of the parliament vehemently slammed such remarks.
In whatever way, direct or indirect, in form of a poem or any other form, such interventionist remarks are vehemently rejected by Iran. We call on the friendly state of Turkey to be watchful about their official statements, which may result in controversy. We respect the territorial integrity of the Azerbaijan Republic and Turkey and expect them to do the same.
The poem recited by Erdogan is ethnically sensitive. A president must know the repercussions of his rhetoric. This was a wrong move by the Turkish president.
Such assertions have always been strongly rejected by the Iranian officials and nation. No one is allowed to talk about Iran's territorial integrity.
Erdogan's statements come as his efforts to join the EU have been futile, and the Europeans impose more and more sanctions on Ankara under different pretexts.
Earlier, the Iranian lawmakers issued a statement condemning the remarks by the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, saying that such remarks may put the security of the region at risk. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
The presidency of Donald Trump has been full of controversy in many cases due to the lawsuits and investigations of a judicial nature that he faces. However, the president has so far managed to avoid them thanks to his position and to the defense provided in some cases by the Department of Justice. This shield has an expiration date, January 20, 2021, when a new president will be inaugurated. From then on, Trump will have to face, as any other citizen, the cases that have been accumulating during these years in the courts.
I think, though, that not only has there have been concerns about what Donald Trump has done before his presidency, I wouldn't be surprised if what he will do after his presidency as well. And so the types of potential criminal allegations that have been brought against him as well as his associates have quite compelling evidence. And I think that it will be hard prosecutors will be hard pressed to ignore that evidence.
The best case scenario for Trump is there are no lawsuits or they're just frivolous and dismissed by the courts. The worst case is that they're going to have something really serious against him where he could possibly even face prison time. This is hypothetical right now. We don't have a real case of that, but there are people digging into it.
Civil cases weigh him. And investigations that could have criminal implications. At the center of the investigations are his taxes, the management of his business, the use of the presidency to benefit his interests, and the defamation complaints of women who accuse him of sexual abuse, which he has denied.
It is very possible that Donald Trump will try to pardon himself. We will be in completely new territory because, again, no president has tried this before. So the courts have never decided if it's legal or not.
Some U.S. media outlets are reporting about Mr. Trump has been asking aid since 2017 if he can self-pardon preemptively, especially on tax fraud accusations. So far, his attorneys have used the immunity argument granted by the presidency. But when he leaves the White House, they will have to reconsider his defense strategy. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Carvello.
After the controversial law on global security and the massive protest against it, the French government has approved another controversial bill, this time called Law on Separatism, provoking again a popular protest. Prime Minister Castex openly said that this bill targets what he called radical Islam, enemy of the Republic. President Emmanuel Macron has promoted the bill to target separatists undermining the nation.
I have the impression that Islamophobia is an important electoral trading issue. I don't think that Marine Le Pen will win the elections, but to prevent that, the actual government is playing on the ground of the far right.
A rarely seen police cordon surrounded the demonstration entirely from the beginning till the end. Every 100 meters, the police charged the demonstration and made arrests. Some were wounded. Macron had said that the presumed radical black bloc has to be destroyed. Therefore, the police had clear orders, zero tolerance. However, this time, the violence did not come from the demonstrators. Human rights groups have raised concerns over the law, saying it would discriminate and stigmatize French Muslims.
There's so much ambiguity in the formulation of the bill that anyone can be accused of anything anytime. The head of police can't dissolve any association on any grounds. With this law, justice does not exist anymore. The democratic state does not exist anymore. Anyone who is a bit annoyed by Muslims can use this law in an arbitrary way. It has to be abolished, same as the law on global security.
The bill in question requires that everyone strictly respects the French Republican principles of secularism, whatever that might mean. The funding of Muslim associations and mosques will be closely monitored. The main association in defense of Muslims, the CCIF, was dissolved. All organizations will have to sign a declaration on secularism if they want to receive funds from the state. In case of non-compliance, they would have to refund the money.
The new bill will be discussed in the French Parliament. Members of the majority party already declared that they want to modify the text. Some want to soften it, others want to make it even more restrictive. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
In a move lauded by Austria's Muslim community, the National Constitutional Court has officially lifted the ban on headscarves at elementary schools. The controversial ban, approved last year by the previous conservative right-wing coalition government, has now been ruled unconstitutional. The court's president says it singles out the religion of Islam unjustifiably, goes against the religious and ideological neutrality of the state, and violates the principle of equality.
The selective ban could have an adverse effect on the inclusion of students and lead to discrimination. It excludes Islamic origin and tradition and carries the risk of making it difficult for Muslim girls to access education and could marginalize them from society.
Austria's Islamic faith community, which had filed a complaint about the ban in January, welcomed the ruling, saying it would end a populist prohibition policy.
We are against constraints and prohibitions because, as it is said in the Holy Quran, there is no compulsion in the matter of faith. Our trust in the rule of law and our patience have paid off.
The ban prevented girls up to the age of 10 from wearing headscarves in school.
I think this is a big step forward because schoolgirls are often discriminated because of their hijab, and with this new rule, they should be able to live it out freely and without any discrimination, even if it's by other school students or teachers. So I think it's kind of a part of a revolution.
While the opposition Social Democrats, the Liberals and the Greens all welcomed the decision, members of the Conservative ruling party called it regrettable, and the right-wing Freedom Party even suggested attempts to reinstate it. The ban's proponents argued they were protecting young girls from being pressured into observing the hijab.
But Muslim families deny this allegation, saying using force against girls who choose to wear the headscarf undermines efforts to give them equal opportunities and self-determination. And this time, they've won the argument. Homa Rezgi, Vienna.
Meeting top Afghan officials to finalize the joint comprehensive strategic document between Iran and Afghanistan was the major reason behind the visit of Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Syed Abbas Araghchi to the Afghan capital Kabul. Analysts say the move will further boost the ties between Iran and Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's deputy foreign minister to Kabul was fruitful for both sides. Both sides have agreed to finalize the joint comprehensive and strategic document between Iran and Afghanistan. This is a win-win deal, helping Kabul and Tehran boost their ties.
In an exclusive interview with Press TV, the Iranian official stressed the importance of expansion of ties between Kabul and Tehran through numerous ways, including increase of strategic partnership in different fields. He also stressed that bringing peace and political stability to Afghanistan under an Afghan-owned process is one of priorities of Tehran's regional policy.
We would remain backing Iraqi Afghan government and people in their fight for their for peace and stability and prosperity. we do consider peace and security in Afghanistan as our own peace and security, and we do consider the prosperity of Afghan people as the prosperity of Iranians. So we are certainly after a good, constructive, mutually beneficial relations with Afghanistan.
The visit of Iran's deputy foreign minister to Kabul comes as both countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have recently inaugurated the first joint railway project connecting western Afghanistan to eastern Iran as a proof of growing cooperation between both countries. Mutual ties between Kabul and Tehran are expanding as both sides are fighting U.S.-sponsored terrorism and sanctions. But the two countries, observers say, have proved that they will never set back against enemies. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The United States passed the green milestone on December 11th as the death toll from coronavirus exceeded the number of Americans killed in combating during the Second World War, says Chris Walker, writer in an article published under the heading U.S. COVID Death Top American Second World War Casualties. Stay tuned for the details, please. The United States passed the green milestone last week as the death toll from coronavirus exceeded the number of Americans killed in combat during the Second World War. As of Friday morning, December 11th, the U.S. has recorded 292,747 deaths from COVID-19. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, the number of U.S. combat deaths in the Second World War was 291,557. Notably, deaths from the coronavirus pandemic have only been recorded for the past year, while U.S. involvement in the Second World War lasted around 4 years. The United States coronavirus numbers surpassed the combat death totals from the Second World War on Thursday evening, December 10th. USA Today reported just hours after a committee of vaccine scientists recorded that Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, authorized the first COVID-19 vaccine for public distribution. While the prospect for a vaccine to stop the spread of the virus is good news, thousands of more Americans are expected to die from COVID-19 before the rollout of inoculations begins. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME, at the University of Washington predicts that the cumulative number of coronavirus casualties will exceed 380,428 deaths by January 20, 2021, an additional 87,681 deaths between now and the inauguration of Joe Biden, or an average of approximately 2,192 deaths per day over the next 48 days. Some experts are predicting that the daily average death rate will end up being much higher. We are in the time frame now that probably for the next 60 to 90 days, we are going to have more deaths per day than we had at 9/11 or we had at Pearl Harbor, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention CDC Director Robert Redfield said during an event hosted by the Council on Foreign Relations earlier this week. Despite these dire predictions, Donald Trump has seemed less concerned about preventing the spread of COVID-19 over the past several weeks. Trump has hosted a slew of holiday parties at the White House, where social distancing standards put forward by the CDC are being ignored. Trump has frequently downplayed the threat of coronavirus to the American people, telling them at many times over the past year that the pandemic would somehow disappear of its own accord. Throughout the year, Trump had been reluctant to back social distancing standards, including encouraging individuals to restrict personal travel and to wear masks, which have been found effective in actually limiting the spread of COVID-19. He has also dangerously downplayed the seriousness of coronavirus in spite of describing the pandemic as deadly earlier this year in an interview with Bob Woodward. Over the past several months, White House officials have demonstrated an eagerness to accept the idea of herd immunity, even going so far as to peddle a petition that signaled support for the concept from supposed medical professionals. While the petition did include real doctors and health professionals who believed in promoting herd immunity, many of the names on the list turned out to be pranks based on common jokes such as Dr. I.P. Freely and Dr. Person Fekney. So-called natural herd immunity, developing immunities within a population without using safely administered inoculations, has been denounced by most health experts as a dangerous method of trying to combat coronavirus. Many have likened it to the practice of eugenics, as it would probably result in millions of deaths among individuals with weaker immune systems. Beyond the mortality rate for COVID, there are grave concerns about its long-term effects among survivors, many of whom are now living with debilitating symptoms. It's also unclear how long these symptoms, which can include blood clots and organ failure, will linger. Promoting natural herd immunity, which Trump and others in his administration have consistently done, would undoubtedly lead to more individuals having to live with these serious long-term health issues.
the debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Illegal settlement activity in full swing. Tel Aviv intends to build 8,300 more settler units in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. The Israeli regime has pressed ahead with the activity in defiance of international law. This has ended up in the forced eviction of Palestinians from their homes. Recently, an Israeli court has given the Palestinians an area, East Jerusalem Al-Quds, 30 days to leave their homes. And this while a few Arab states have clinched so-called Washington brokered normalization deals with Israel, yet the settlements are growing despite Tel Aviv's promise to suspend them in exchange for those agreements. Now let's go to Ramallah and ask Mona Kandil for an update on the latest illegal Israeli settlement expansion. Mona.
Israeli media on Wednesday revealed that the Israeli authorities approved the building of 8,300 settler units in East Jerusalem Al-Quds, with the confiscation of lands from the villages of Beit Safafa, Malha, and Baqa, all the way to Al-Walaji village, northwest Beit Lahm in the occupied West Bank. According to the reports, the construction will be for residential, commercial, and industrial purposes. The Palestinian Authority slammed the Israeli plan and says it's a green light from the Israeli authorities to continue confiscation of lands and impose more facts on ground. It seems that the Israeli regime is racing against time in order to impose more facts on ground, in order to confiscate more lands and expand the illegal settlements before the outgoing U.S. administration leaves office, because they know that the current American administration has given the green light for the Israeli authorities to continue expanding the settlements. At the same time, the Israeli authorities also approved the building and the construction of roads between the settlements and the occupied West Bank in order to link the settlements together. And this is also the main aim of these roads, is to facilitate the confiscation of the lands. There were reports recently from the Israeli authorities saying that the Israeli regime is working to make the number of the Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank to reach 1 million. Today we are speaking about 500,000 of settlers in the occupied West Bank and 250 settlers living in the illegal settlements in Jerusalem Al-Quds.
Okay, thank you for that. That was Mona Kandil with an update from Ramallah. Now, joining me in this show tonight will be from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, Ken Stone, out of Hamilton, Ontario, and also National Co-Director of the Code Pink, Ariel Gold, who is joining us out of New York. Good to have both of you on the show. Let's go to Ken. Tel Aviv this year has had a target of building 3,000 settlement homes in the West Bank and making 2020 one of the most prolific years for illegal settlement activity. Now, settlement watchdog group Peace Now says that this is by far the highest number of approvals since Trump took office and also the highest since Peace Now started watching those figures in 2012. What's your assessment?
Well, I'd like to preface my remarks by, first of all, wishing Ms. Goldberg and all the Jewish viewers of Press TV a happy Hanukkah, and point out that an ever-increasing number of Jews in North America do not support the Zionist colonial project and in fact participate in BDS and other initiatives to support the Palestinian people. So to your question about the settlements, these settlements are flagrantly illegal. They are violations of international law, and they are in violation of numerous UN resolutions which call for them to be dismantled, taken away, and the land turned over, the occupation ended, and the land turned over to the Palestinian people to be part of a Palestinian, independent Palestinian state. Now, why so many more settlements this year and in the last few years? It's clearly because the Israeli government has gotten the green light from a president who's probably the most friendly president to Israel that we have ever seen. And the green light came in the form of moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem for endorsing the plan to annex most of the West Bank outright and the plan to annex the Golan Heights, which are part of the sovereign state of Syria. So having this president in place and the green light of all these three measures which I just mentioned has given the Israeli government the confidence and also the money and the backing and security to go ahead with an increased, completely illegal settlement program.
Now let's turn to New York. Ariel, Tel Aviv had promised to put on hold the plans to annex parts of the West Bank in return for Washington-brokered normalization deals with Arab states. And you know the deals were signed in return for prizes from Washington, but settlement expansion has not stopped. It's even accelerated. Why is that?
What a farce that these normalization deals had anything to do with peace or with stopping annexation. We know what was given to the Arab states in return for normalizing apartheid, because that's what was normalized, apartheid and occupation. The UAE is set to receive a massive weapons deal, including the coveted, deadly F-35 fighter jets. And now with Morocco having normalized relations with Israel, the Morocco is in exchange receiving recognition from the United States for its illegal occupation of Western Sahara, as well as a $1 billion weapons deal. So these normalization deals have nothing to do with peace at all, and they have nothing to do with stopping annexation. That was a complete farce. This is about normalizing violence, normalizing apartheid, normalizing occupation, and normalizing the influx of weapons into the Middle East.
Can you remember Tel Aviv had promised that this is what it will do? It will put on hold, at least, or postpone the settlement expansion. But you see, the reverse is happening. You know, every day there is ratification on top of ratification, expanding more and more settlements.
Oh, I couldn't agree with Ms. Gold more. In fact, there is a further element that could be mentioned here. The trade minister of Bahrain recently said that Bahrain would accept all kinds of Israeli goods, even goods from the illegal settlements, to be shipped into Bahrain. And then, of course, Bahrain would become the gateway for these products to go be distributed throughout the Arab world. The UAE did almost the same thing. They have already accepted wines that are produced in Israel from grapes grown in the Golan Heights, which belongs to Syria, and those are already for sale in the UAE, and a delegation of settler colonists from the illegally occupied West Bank of Palestine went to Dubai, which is part of the UAE, and they struck a deal with the UAE to ship out their products of their illegal settlements. So these countries that said, oh, we're going to stop the annexation of the West Bank, they are actually becoming business partners of the illegal settlements. That's how much of a sham it is.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately. Now, Ariel, Palestinians want the entire West Bank as part of their future independent state, and they are complaining that this growing illegal settlement expansion has made it increasingly difficult for them to achieve their dream of independence. So what will become of an independent Palestinian state with Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital, given the circumstances?
I think that the whole world has to accept that the two-state solution is so long past dead. How many funerals can we have for what is now an unachievable situation? It is already one singular state between the river and the sea, but it is one apartheid state. And this has now become a rights-based struggle where we have to support Palestinians to achieve their basic human rights, including the right to vote, including the right to not live under a military regime, their rights to equality, and so much more. This is now a rights-based situation from a long time ago. And it's really Israel that both caused this and now in many ways is going to have to deal with the ramifications of that, because it is Israel that is obsessed with maintaining a demographic majority, which cannot be maintained if full rights and equality are secured for all people.
Mm-hmm. Ken, do you also believe that a two-state solution is dead? What is the solution?
Oh, the solution is clear. It's a Palestinian state in all of occupied Palestine, and all of historic Palestine. Mm-hmm. And that's the position that the Iranian government has taken, and that's the position that many Palestinians have taken. Now, as Ms. Gold has pointed out, right now Israel is, and it's the occupied territories, is part of one unified apartheid regime. And the struggle now has to be against apartheid and against that regime, which has justified itself by a horrible law called the National Law, I believe, which states that the Israeli government is a government that is in favor of a Jewish state, and which will benefit its Jewish citizens only at the expense of all of its other citizens. So people around the world should take note and say, just in the way, as in the way we boycotted and we tried to divest pension funds and we sanctioned the former apartheid state of South Africa and helped to achieve majority government there, so we need to work with the Palestinian people who have called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and sanction, boycott, and call for divestment of pension plans in the rest of the world that are invested in the state of Israel, to bring about, bring down the apartheid regime and create a one state where Jews and Arabs can live together in peace and all the Palestinian refugees can return.
Okay. Now, Ariel, all the U.S. administrations and the international community have opposed Tel Aviv settlement construction that's deemed to be illegal under international law. Donald Trump is the only U.S. president who adopted a different approach and defied his predecessors. What made him act that way?
Well, I might have to challenge that idea that Donald Trump was the only U.S. president that adopted that. Other U.S. presidents did so by non-action. So other U.S. presidents, while condemning settlement growth or mm-hmm. asking Israel not to expand settlement, did not actually put any teeth behind that, which is in itself an implicit approval. And Israel knew very much that there were no consequences, that there were no conditions upon which it really must behave. So what Donald Trump did is he actually did this in the full daylight, and it has been grotesque and horrifying to watch, but it isn't really too out of line with previous U.S. presidents. We saw President Obama condemn settlements. We even saw him let a U.N. resolution go through at the end of his term. Yet also at the end of his term, he increased U.S. military aid to Israel. So as far as Israel is seeing, they are getting this U.S. military aid, and they see that as a green light, because in fact it is a green light.
Yeah, and Ken, we see that the Trump administration is also trying its best in the last days there at the Oval Office. You know, a while ago we had Secretary of State paying a visit there, and he was the first to visit the Golan Heights, you know, there, and they're called Trump Heights. And also, in broad daylight, they simply, he went as far as saying that the settlement activity is not illegal.
Well, if you want my take on it, the U.S. government has, as Ms. Gold has pointed out, always supported the state of Israel. It's enabled it, and so has the Canadian government. The Canadian government allows the settlement goods to be sold in Canada as, quote, products of Israel. There's a big case that independent Jewish voices and others in Canada have been fighting about that. And the Canadian government allows charitable status to the Jewish National Fund, which raises money to build the settlements in the occupied West Bank and in the Golan Heights as well. So these are the Western governments are the enablers of this occupation. And I was watching the U.S. Election pretty carefully, and I did not see that Mr. Biden said that he would do anything differently. He did not say he would move the embassy back to Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. He did not say he would rescind the endorsement of the annexation of the West Bank. He did not say that he would rescind the endorsement of the Golan Heights. And none of the liberals in the U.S. Who complained so bitterly about these things even asked him to do it. So, frankly, I don't think the policy is going to even change with the new administration on January the 20th.
Yeah, what Ariel, what Ken just mentioned brings me to my next question regarding a new president at the Oval Office. Do you expect any changes as regards settlement activity in the Palestinian cause?
Unfortunately, we do not expect much. We are seeing great changes, though, in Congress and in American opinion and in American Jewish opinion. And so we know where our strengths are, and we know very much where we need to do our work.
Mm-hmm, I see. So, Ken, don't you see any light at the end of the tunnel for the Palestinians during the, let's say, Biden presidency?
The only light I see at the end of the tunnel for the Palestinian cause is if the Palestinian leadership stops relying on the leaders of those Arab states which are clients of the U.S. empire, which are already in the pocket of the U.S. government. I think that the Palestinian movement should follow the example of the resistance front, that is to say, the governments of Iran, Syria, and of Hezbollah in Lebanon. They have shown the way to resist successfully the Israeli occupation and annexation plan. And I think that the way forward for liberation for the Palestinian people is the path of resistance.
And Ariel, what kind of a prospect can you imagine for Tel Aviv's annexation plans in future? Is there anything that can put a halt to this illegal move?
Well, I have to disagree with my colleague in terms of looking to places like Syria, where there are gross human rights abuses as well. I think this is about building global solidarity and about coming together through nonviolent struggle and continuing the work that we're doing, where we are seeing successes, like in shifting U.S. Congress and in shifting opinion. And we have to support the Palestinian nonviolent struggle on the ground.
Mm-hmm. What about my question? How far will this annexation plan and settlement activity go on?
Well, it looks like it's going to go on quite quickly and quite extensively. We've seen that for many, many decades now, which has brought it to the one-state reality that it is.
Mm-hmm. So, Ken, what is it that can stop this illegal push, the settlement activity? Is it only Palestinian unity and United States?
Well, as I said before, stop relying on the Arab leaders already in the pockets of the U.S. empire. Mm-hmm. And follow the example of the resistance front. But I agree with Ms. Gold that it requires solidarity from people who believe in freedom and self-determination around the world. And it means that people in the West especially should be organizing to pressure their governments to stop enabling this Zionist occupation by removing the support for Israel at the United Nations, and by stopping the funding to Israel and stopping the fundraising for Israel within their jurisdictions.
All right, on that note, we come to the end of this debate. Let me thank my guests from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. We had Ken Stone from Hamilton, Ontario, and also National Co-Director of the Code Pink, Ariel Gould, who joined us out of New York.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The New York Times reported on Wednesday, December 9th, that more than a third of Americans are living in areas where hospitals are running critically short on ICU beds, while one in 10 people are served by medical centers where fewer than 5% of beds are currently available. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading, As Pandemic Overwhelms Hospitals, One-Third of Americans Live in Areas Where ICUs Close to Capacity. Public health officials say there is evidence that healthcare workers in the U.S. are beginning to ration care for COVID-19 patients, and at least one state governor is expected to announce that care rationing must begin to save the lives of those most likely to survive the disease, as intensive care unit beds across the U.S. approach capacity. The New York Times reported on Wednesday, December 9th, that more than a third of Americans are living in areas where hospitals are running critically short of ICU beds, while one in 10 people are served by medical centers where fewer than 5% of beds are currently available. According to the outlet's interactive map, in places including Lake Havasu City, Arizona, and Ogden, Utah, zero ICU beds are available. The news comes as the Department of Health and Human Services, for the first time during the coronavirus pandemic that began in March, published detailed geographic data about COVID-10 hospitalizations. Public health experts have for months called on the federal government to release such information to better help officials understand where the pandemic has hit the hardest. Last week, the Santa Fe, New Mexico, reported that Democratic Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is expected to allow hospitals to begin rationing care based on which patients have the greatest chance of survival if they receive treatment. The Times reported that in Albuquerque, New Mexico, 116% of ICU beds are now occupied, with healthcare workers using 32 extra hospital beds to treat severely ill COVID-19 patients. March for Our Lives activist Yas Mendoza tweeted recently that her city of Fresno, California, is facing similar statistics, noting that patients who need intensive care for non-coronavirus emergencies are increasingly unable to use ICU beds. In New Mexico, Dr. Jason Mitchell, chief medical officer of one of the state's largest hospital systems, called on residents to help healthcare workers avoid having to make gut-wrenching decisions about who should receive care. This is an incredibly concerning time for our entire community, and especially for our clinicians and staff, Mitchell said on Saturday, December 5th. We will care for our patients as safely and effectively as possible. We urge our fellow New Mexicans to prevent the further spread of COVID-19 by limiting gatherings, practicing social distancing, masking up, and staying home wherever possible. Dr. Thomas Tassai, an assistant professor of health policy at Harvard University, told The Times that there has been evidence of other hospitals rationing care in recent weeks by making decisions about which COVID-19 patients can be hospitalized. The rate of the overall hospitalizations have decreased over the past several weeks as ICUs have approached capacity. That suggests that there is some rationing and stricter triage criteria about who gets admitted as hospitals remain full, Desai told The Times. Meanwhile, public health officials say a surge in infections linked to Thanksgiving gatherings and travel is likely to emerge in the coming days. Traffic on Thanksgiving Day was down only 5% from 2019, indicating that many families gathered in enclosed spaces and have since been out in their communities. On social media, Dr. Abrar Karen of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston implored the public to continue following public health protocols and avoid enclosed gathering spaces like restaurants, even though they are allowed to be open in many states. "Is this recommendation I am making fair to restaurants and staff?" he wrote. "What's actually